This week on Writers, Inc.
This is basically my way of setting up a series where I've got lots of places where I can kill people. I learned early on when I was writing my Grant County series that I made the town a little too small. So this is a redo of that with a larger canvas on which to write these stories.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tumlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So show of hands, who is getting spam emails right now writer-related stuff?
Oh, not writer-related. Spam
I got four this week from PR and marketing people. It's ridiculous. Like all this AI.
And I've gotten four today just, you know, for like AI movie trailers and stuff like that. And like, I'm wondering if it like, they must be using AI to not only kick these out, but to generate them. And like, I don't know what mailing list I'm on, but like, it's definitely getting worse.
Yeah.
I've gotten a ton and I get them every day, but they're clearly finding me through something like because I paid to do like a book trib review of one of my books a long time ago. Got nothing out of it except a whole lot of spam over the years, but that's the one they're zeroing in on. Like, I read your book, Spanish Papers, and they give me this like diatribe, like I love the action and adventure and the intrigue of finding these documents, and like, okay, yeah, this is so AI written, but I get like 100 of those a day, man. Not even exaggerating.
I'm wondering if we can drop the email into the AI and somehow trace it back to the original source and figure out where the email, like how they got your email address.
That would be interesting.
People sell their lists. That's the...
Yeah, they all sell them, but like, there might be a way to like figure out where your email actually appears, like where that list is and who has it. And I don't know that you could stop it.
The weird one I'm getting now is on LinkedIn. Every other day I get somebody who says, I do market research and I've got a client that wants to pay you for your opinions. And I did one just to see, and they got a whole bunch of opinions out of me and I got no money out of them. But it was one of those like, yeah, well, this was just the introductory interview, so I'll be recommending you. So they'll follow up and they'll pay you in advance, et cetera. But it never happens. So I don't respond anymore, but I get dozens of those.
Yeah.
It's like Publishers Clearinghouse. I've given up on that too.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for my big check.
I didn't tell you, but I told JD I sent it to him. The best one I got was for JD and James Patterson. And it got to my email somehow to Market the Writer. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure Jim is waiting on this email.
That's funny.
I don't know why I got it, but yeah, there's some kind of list somewhere.
Wow.
Frustrating. All right. And Jenna, how did we impress your brother? You mentioned something about this right before we hit the record button.
Yeah, you helped me. I was able to finally impress my brother. But it is related to one of your books, but it's more related to your co-author. Apparently James Patterson is his number. Yes, you, Kevin, is like his top author. So he's been listening to the podcast for a while, and I get this random text the other night that's like, is J.D. Barker writes with James Patterson? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, and that's the same J.D. Barker on your podcast? And I'm like, yeah. And he was like, oh my God. So
how many J.D. Barkers do we think there might be in the world? I should look that up.
It can't be that. I've got the trademark. I literally own the trademark on the name, so there can't be that many out there.
It's like there's babies being born to Barker families right now, and the doctors are like, no, sir, you cannot name your child J.D.
It's not obvious that the J.D. Barker on the podcast is the same.
Oh, you should tell your brother we interviewed Patterson a couple of times on the show. I should probably get him back on because it's been a few years. But
I
think we've got
about
two
Mr.
or three
Beast.
Of them out there.
Get them
Yeah,
both on.
we've.
That'd be fun.
There you go. That's actually a good idea.
I don't know if I've ever actually impressed my brother. So, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Just
being a
congratulations.
senior who's
And
associated with Patterson has elevated my currency.
totally unrelated news, Christine, you bought a new computer.
I did. It just arrived today.
Yeah.
I usually go to the Apple store, but I didn't want to deal with it. And they're like, you can just do it yourself with online support and transfer your stuff. So that will be my weekend.
Easy. Oh, it'll take you less
Yeah,
than
I'm
an
like,
hour.
there's
Yeah,
like,
it's
what do
nothing.
I need to
No.
do? You know, I have licenses for everything. You just re-download the apps, and I don't want all this junk on my new computer. I
You can
wanted it
just,
clean.
oh,
So,
I see. Because you can
yeah.
just mirror. That's, I just, it'll just like you connect your two Macs and it'll just like take everything. Yeah,
Yeah,
I don't
so
want
much has
everything.
changed, man.
You bring all the problems come over when you do it that way too. Like Christine's do it the harder way, but it's the better way because you just start
Yeah.
with a clean slate. And
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Macs don't get gummed up, like Windows does. Like it's not quite as
No.
bad, but like I've got a weird plugin from a Sonos thing that I used to use on there years ago, and like it transfers over from one Mac to the next, and it gives me a warning message. Like once a month, I get a message saying this plugin's no longer valid, and I'll click on the little readme thing that pops up with it, and like it takes me to like a random web page, so it doesn't tell me how to get rid of it. And like I've searched a million different ways, so like the only way to get rid of it is going to be a clean install.
Yes.
But yeah, so
I
we were
guess.
talking about that though earlier in the week when you were trying to figure out what to get. And like as a writer, like you want to load it up with absolutely everything you can because you're really not taxing it that much. When you're writing books, you're not really putting it through the paces. It's not like you're
Yeah.
editing video or rendering stuff. But you still want to load it up as best you can. And like with
Yeah.
Macs, it's tricky just because you have to do it, out of the gate. You can't upgrade them anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've had this one for 10 years, so I went kind of middle of the road upper. I didn't go all the way up because I was like, if I have to replace it in 3 years, I don't care. I've had
Yeah.
this one 10 years, so
Well, that,
I
yeah.
honestly, I probably wouldn't have upgraded, except I can't upgrade my whatever your iOS. I'm like three behind or whatever,
Oh, yeah,
which is annoying.
that'll
So,
start really mucking things up once
yeah.
you do the updates. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, ah, I need a new one, although this one runs fine. So 10 years.
When I started writing full time, I told myself I would get a new Mac, with every book, every time I start a new book, just like Lee Child
Holy
does. But like
smokes.
I write a book about every 3 or 4 months, so that's like it's more trouble than it's worth.
I
Like
guess
the upgrades just
you just
aren't
start
there.
doing them as giveaways. Like, here's another one.
He just signs the laptop, throws it in the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, like my last one, I think like the trade in on it was like $300. Like when we finally got around to plugging it in, and like that's not worth it. So yeah,
No.
I've got a
Right.
closet full of old Macs. I probably should do something with.
Isn't that something though? Because like you're trading, like you could get $300 for it, but instead you're just going to stick it in a closet.
Well,
I mean, I'm the same way. I'm exactly the same way, but it's like, yeah, that's not worth it. And I'd rather not
No.
get anything for it.
No, my trade-in value was crickets, so I'm just going to keep this in case I
The
need to
thing
get something later.
there's always like a niece or a nephew or, someone that I will eventually use it. Like they need a first computer and the parents don't want to spend money on it. That's how I look at it.
Well,
Yeah.
my general thinking was like putting it in the closet. I would use it like when I travel and leave the good Mac at home,
Yeah.
which
Yeah.
is like I always have, but then like I book a trip, the trip comes up, then it's like the night before the trip and I'm packing and I'm like, holy crap, I got to get one of the Macs ready if I really want to do that. And then, you pull it out
Right.
of the closet, you got to do all these updates to it, and like
Yeah.
then it's not worth it either. So
Yeah, it's not worth
yeah,
it.
I don't know.
The plight
For
of modern man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My next is I
That's
have to get
true.
a new phone and phone plan, and I'm trying to compare, and that'll be my nightmare for the next few days. So,
Yeah.
Oh boy.
my phone battery is, I barely use my phone all day, and it's like 20%,
Yeah.
like mid-afternoon. So I guess that's a sign.
So, okay. This is my last laptop related story, and then we'll read the news. But Apple has this thing where your laptop, it can actually to preserve the battery, it has a setting. And you can turn it off, but I never have. But it's only going to charge it to like 80%, and so that's fine. I don't mind trying to kind of lengthen the lifespan of the battery or whatever. But what happens to me 1,000% of the time is I pick up this laptop to go, run and do some writing from a coffee shop or something, and I get there and it's down to like 75%. So it, and there's no outlets available. So it just cuts down on my writing time. So that's an annoying feature.
That happened to me in Greece, and that feature, like, I turned it off because that drives me nuts. Because you know, it's plugged in 99.9% of the time, you know, so then it just keeps adjusting it down. Mine actually sits there, was sitting at 50%. So yeah, I did the same thing. I wanted to go right out on the beach, so I grabbed the Mac, I hopped on a, you know, a chair and sat down and looked, and like it was like 50%, 49%, 47%. You know, I was out of there in like an hour, because like it's never, you know, like it's supposed to last like 10 or 12 hours or whatever. That's complete BS. And when it starts getting to those lower percentages, it starts dropping fast.
Oh, it goes so fast. My laptop the other night, it was like, you know, it did the thing. I think it was like 20%, and I was like, okay, I've got a few minutes. And then like all of a sudden it just shut down. Like I was like, what happened to the 10% warning?
That wasn't a 20%, it was saying 20 seconds.
Right. Yeah, it was a countdown.
Well, let's get in the news. First up, bookshop.org reports 65% growth. Ebooks add $1 million in sales. Bookshop.org sales are soaring despite industry-wide sales being down so far this year. Their CEO attributes $1 million of additional revenue to their better late than never ebook platform, which launched in January, and another $1.5 million to its recent anti-Prime sale. It seems anti-Amazon sentiment has hit a tipping point.
Anti-Prime sale. Okay.
Anti-Prime.
If it's working.
I like to see this grow. Bookshop.org has a kind of a mission at its heart, is in addition to being kind of a retail outlet, supports local bookshops. So I like hearing good news about it. I need to
No, these
utilize
guys
it
are
more.
great. They kept a lot of bookstores open during COVID. And like that would, without them, there's so many stores that would have just shut their doors. So yeah, anything they do is fantastic if there's a way to support it.
Yeah, always nice to see someone rivaling Amazon. So
Do you
that's
think that
good.
they would support JD? You and I were talking about the book vending machines. Do you think if we started a little book vending machine business, you think we could partner up with bookshop.org? We should do that.
Know, so here's the thing. So we didn't talk about this on the air, right?
No.
I don't think so.
So yeah,
No.
so
Should I
we
have
used
not
to.
mentioned
Well, you got to
it?
throw a disclaimer out there. So we found, I forget how we got on that topic, but I think you mentioned a book
I
vending
found
machine or
something.
something. And then I actually sent you a link to the real ones. I used to own a bunch of vending machines, and they're really cool sources of income, but like they get so vandalized and destroyed, and like people just abuse the hell out of them. It's a problem, and like I'm not sure how that would play out with books, but I'm thinking about putting one in my wife's latest project. She's opening an indoor entertainment center for kids. Like it's got zip lines and all kinds of stuff like that. And you know, I see so many moms in those kind of places just sitting in the, you know, the recliners that have, you know, massage things built in, you know, like paying for that. Like they would easily buy a book and sit there. So I guess you just got to pick and choose where you put them.
I can, and I can think of half a dozen places where I would feel it would be moderately safe. Because it's not like, this isn't like a soda machine or a candy bar machine. I mean, you're not, you know, they'll put those anywhere, but you wouldn't, by any logic, put a book vending machine, say, at a car wash, or you know, like you're just, that's just not gonna, it's not gonna do well. You just know that. So
Maybe a
coffee
car
shops,
dealership,
hotels,
you know,
maybe.
service.
I would put one in a car wash only because people are sitting there waiting for their car to come out looking for something to do.
Well,
You know,
remind
any
me
place where people
sometime.
are.
I'll tell you some stories about a younger Kevin and his shenanigans at car washes. So, which has convinced me to never put anything of value at a car wash. So, but
All right.
anyway,
Moving
all right.
on. Next
Next
story.
up, forgetting about any larceny in Kevin's past, Gen Z hooks up with, quote, read dating, as in like speed dating. You get it? All right. Gen Z has become so bored of dating apps that some of them have even created a business named after their ennui. The startup began hosting IRL dating events in bookstores in New York in 2023, and now they've taken the trend across the pond. At read dating events, attendees bring a book inscribed with their contact info to share with someone they wanted to get to know better. Like Serendipity. You ever see that movie, Serendipity?
I don't know. This is so cute, though.
Nope.
Vaguely, I kind of vague. There was a the lead was a blonde, right? I don't know.
I don't know. But my
Feels
question here
familiar.
is, what if they give you a book that you hated and then it's kind of,
Well, that's
then I
the.
guess you're not a match, right?
I'm wondering how they're picking the books because, you know, like they're not necessarily picking a book that they like. They're picking a book that they could use to impress, right? So it's there's motivation. Didn't we have a story like 6 months ago about people like fake reading books on the
Oh
subway and
yeah.
stuff just to try
Yeah.
and yeah. So this feels like an extension of that in a
Okay, but
way.
I could justify that. And here's something. Here's what I think would work for this. It's like you are trying to attract the kind of partner that you feel most compatible with, right? So on the one hand, maybe that's somebody who enjoys this book that I loved would probably click well with me.
There you
On the
go.
other hand, it could be I want the type of person who would enjoy this classic book or whatever. And then if you let them come to you, two things happen. You're qualifying, right? Like, you know, they obviously thought you were cute or they wouldn't have approached, and they saw the book you had, and that's the book that they resonated with. So now you've kind of qualified them as a lead, as it were. And
Yeah.
so,
So that would be interesting because my husband and I read totally different genres. So I
yeah.
guess I'd have to read my leave my sci-fi fantasy books at home and bring some noir. Here's your Chandler.
I
I guess. I don't know. I think, do you really need them to like what you read, though? I mean, my husband doesn't even really read a lot of fiction anyway. Like, put on a documentary and he's all about it, which I also find interesting, but like, I don't necessarily need him to
Yeah.
read. I don't know. People get.
This might be a fun exercise. Just ask your significant other what book they would bring to the bookstore and try and meet somebody, just
Yeah.
to see what they come up
I
with.
don't think mine
I'm
would
gonna
even go
ask.
to the bookstore. So,
I'm honestly thinking Gen Z's got some problems because like I'm reading Wired magazine right now, and there's an article in there about some people that did a couples retreat with their AI companions. So it's people basically showed up at they rented a cabin. I think it was in Pennsylvania. Like multiple couples, you know, they called them couples, but it was literally like a person showing up with their iPad because their companion was an AI companion. And it was yeah, it was like the weirdest thing. And I believe this was Gen Z too. So I don't
Yeah.
know. I feel like
I
I
don't
need to cross the
know.
street when the Gen Zer is on the same side of the road as me.
I saw a whole thing where, you know, there's a huge criticism of like people are now dating AI,
Yeah.
marrying AI, whatever. And so look, I have a different take. My whole take is I am happy enough to see these people remove themselves from the gene pool. I didn't want them
Kevin.
here anyway. So
I don't know, man. I can see it being a woman. I'm like, oh, I just get to have peace. Cool. Anyway.
well, there is a strong, bold argument to be made there,
Yeah,
but
I did get my first ad on Instagram this week for an AI boyfriend. I was kind of insulted. I'm like, I don't need an AI boyfriend, but
I
that
did
was the
too, and I
first time
don't
I
get
saw
that.
that. All
yeah.
Right. Final story. Why Benjamin Percy is writing a novel as a newspaper with Stephen King. Benjamin Percy is serializing a new post-apocalyptic novel, The End Times, as an actual newspaper in both print and digital over a year, complete with comic strips, then collecting the issues into a book that preserves the newspaper feel. It's a pushback against screen fatigue and a celebration of physical media and local journalism. In the story, a woman revives a press and starts a paper, letting Percy play with epistolary form to make readers more emotionally open. Stephen King is contributing ideas and articles. I want to point out, by the way, that Christine pulls together these news stories and she purposely puts words in them, like
I left a name out for you
ennui
this
and
week.
epistolary.
You'll go back to that where it just says CEO. I cut the name out. So you're
Yeah.
welcome.
Okay. This is a
Think
neat
this is
idea.
cool, though. I think this
Yeah,
is a
this is
neat
very cool.
idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would read this.
Yeah.
It got me thinking of do you remember a book called House of Leaves?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I
You guys
love that
ever
book. Daniel Uskey. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a fantastic book too, but you can
That would
pretty
be
much
the book I
own
hold
that.
up at a read a speed read or a read dating thing. That would be my book.
There you
Really?
go, House of Leaves.
No, it would not.
It's a little pretentious, but okay.
You're gonna get some interesting responses. Either no one's gonna know what it is, or they're gonna be like, interesting choice. Like that.
I was just trying to think of examples of, you know, like a book that only sort of works in one particular format, because like I would read this book for sure, but I definitely want to read the print version. You know, like if it was actually laid out like a newspaper, I would probably even take that over an actual, you know, like bound book, just to try and keep that vibe going.
I'm
I'm not sure
imagining
that.
the bound book is probably going to be like what they do with like graphic novels and things. Like it's probably going to still be print or look like a newspaper print, but
I'm not sure how audiobook would work either, but yeah, cool idea. Cool thinking outside the box.
yeah, and I was surprised. Well, I guess I'm not surprised that Stephen King's involved with it, but it's kind of gimmicky, but I guess he's kind of done things like that in the past, right? Like he's
It's
done
kind of
gimmicky.
neat,
Yeah,
though. He technically did one of the first ebooks. I think it was called The Plant, if I remember right. But like he offered it, you know, from his website, you know, like way before Kindle was out there. You know, so he tries new things every once in a while.
That's cool.
I want my next story by Telegraph. Can we bring that back?
This book was written entirely in Morse code.
Interesting. Okay. Entirely in Morse code. Wow. Do it, Kevin. If anyone can pull that off, it's you.
That's it. That's, it's got to tie into one of your archaeology.
I think that should be your brand slogan. If anyone can pull this off, it's me.
No one wants to do this, but if anyone can pull it off, it's J. Kevin Tomlinson.
I forgot the J. I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's okay.
Oh.
I'm still working it into every conversation now. All right. Well, that's it
Wonderful.
for the news.
Okay, cool.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Karen Slaughter back on. Karen is the author of more than 20 New York Times bestsellers. Many have been adapted to film or television. Pieces of her hit number one on Netflix, and her Will Trent series is currently streaming on ABC and Hulu. Her latest novel is called We Are All Guilty Here and releases August 12th. Here she is, Karen Slaughter.
Well, we were chatting just before the interview, and this is the first time that you and I have had a chance to chat with each other, Karen, but welcome to the Writers Inc. podcast.
Thank you.
So, we're going to be talking about your new upcoming book, We Are All Guilty Here, which seems like an appropriate title these days. So I can't wait to dive into that. But it's the first in a new series that you're launching, the North Falls Thrillers. This is book one.
That's right.
What's the can you kind of run me through sort of the what's the origin of the series? Like, what's the focal point going to be there?
Well, I guess it's mostly about this family, the Clifton family, who have controlled this county in southwest Georgia for generations. And North Falls is the main seat of the county. It's the smallest of all the cities, and it's where the wealthy people live. You know, this is a typical setup of any, not metropolitan area, but any like mostly rural area where you have a really wealthy city beside a very poor one, and there's a technical college, there's an auto factory, auto parts factory. So this is basically my way of setting up a series where I've got lots of places where I can kill people. I learned early on when I was writing my Grant County series that I made the town a little too small. So this is a redo of that with a larger canvas on which to write these stories.
Serial killers and thriller writers. We're always on the hunt for the perfect killing grounds.
Exactly.
So, all right. I'm hoping this is not necessarily a real place. This isn't like an actual place somewhere. You've made it
No.
whole cloth.
I did. I put it on an actual river, the Flint River, and part of that was just I love the Flint River because the headwaters are under the Atlanta airport. So, you know, the old joke is everybody goes through two things before they die. They have to pay taxes and they have to go through the Atlanta airport. So everybody has basically been at the headwaters of the Flint River. And I think that's a good way to talk about these stories that I'm going to be telling in this series, is they're going to come from all different kinds of places.
Now you're going to be introducing a whole new protagonist in this. I had the name and I Emmy
Emmy
Clifton.
Clifton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the backstory for Officer Emmy Clifton?
She is a deputy at the sheriff's department for Clifton County, and her father is the sheriff. And she's part of the poor Cliftons. Now, the Cliftons have had
Okay.
like a finger in every pie of
Yeah.
government. You know, the school board, the mayor, the police department, the prosecutor's office. And I would be lying if I didn't say I was thinking a little bit about the Murdaugh murders when I wrote
Oh,
this
yeah.
first book, because, you know, I think as Americans, we have this idealized Mayberry version of these dynastic families in these small towns. But
Right.
anybody who's lived in a small town will tell you that they're horrible. Absolute power definitely corrupts. So you've got these families where the rules are different for them. And if you know them or you're connected to them, you're going to be okay. But if you don't, then you know you're, the every rule of the law is going to be applied to you. So
Yeah.
there's definitely that feel of inside and outside the circle.
Do you have that in your background, the small towns with all their secrets and everything? Is that part of your upbringing?
Absolutely. You know, I grew up in a small town of Jonesboro, Georgia, and my dad was definitely part of that good old boy network. And he was the head of the our local political party. He was the treasurer for them. And you know, if somebody wanted to get elected, they had to go through my dad and their friends and his friends. And that's just how it worked. And it still works that way in a lot of small towns.
Yeah. I grew up in a small town in Texas, and that's what politics is. It's who do you
Yeah.
know? Who do you not who do you know, but who are you related
Exactly.
to? And what favors have you done for them lately?
Yeah.
So, what are I mean, you're launching a whole new series here. What made you decide like this is something I can explore in such depth that it requires more than one book? Like what's the impetus?
Well, I was excited. You know, this is my 25th book, so I've done
Yeah.
quite a few books. And when I wrote my Grant County series, I wasn't even published, you know, when I wrote the first one. And then when I wrote the first Will Trent novel, I didn't know if it was going to be a series. I hoped, but I didn't know. So
Yeah.
this is an opportunity of, you know, as a writer, knowing my publisher's going to publish at least three or four of these things. And thinking, okay, well, I want to really be deliberate in writing a series, and I want to plant a lot of seeds that will grow into later novels. And so I was able to do that. And, you know, a lot of world building that I did in this book, you know, hopefully it feels seamless, but it was my way of planting those seeds and making sure that there were various avenues for more stories to tell.
Yeah. How far ahead do you get when you're planning something like this, a series like
Well,
this?
usually I've always been the kind of writer that when I'm writing a book, I have an idea for at least the next one, sometimes two or three ahead.
Wow, okay.
So with this one, when I was writing it, I had the ideas for two more in the series. But I should say that I'm going to keep writing Will Trent and Sarah Linton novels too. I haven't given up on that. This isn't a replacement. It's
Yeah.
just a different outlet for different types of stories.
What is it about writers that we just decide we can take more. We're gonna pile more on.
Yeah.
I'm not giving
Well,
up anything. I'm just gonna
yeah.
add to.
Well, you know, I feel like you're lucky if you're a writer and you can do that. I've always had the complete support of my publisher. They've never been prescriptive with me. It's always, what do you want to write next? What are you interested in? And I think that's one of the reasons why I've been able to maintain my career at this level is because my publishers just let me do what I want to do.
Yeah. Is this scratching a different itch for you than the other books though? I mean,
It is. It's a sort of light return to where I started.
yeah.
Because, you know, when you write books in a small town, there's a very emotional connection.
Yeah.
Because invariably someone knows someone. And, you know, in this book, we are all guilty here. Emmy knows one of the victims of the crime that kicks off the book. So it's her best friend's stepdaughter. And in a lot of ways, when you write something psychological or dark, it's driven by personal connection, and that's what
Yeah.
gives it that feeling of this is a real person, this is really happening. When I write a Will Trent novel, you know, he's in Atlanta, There are personal things going on between him and Sarah and his partner, and you know, there's all those relationships, but generally it's not someone he knows or he's connected to. Or Sarah, you know, because Atlanta is such a, the metropolitan area is 8 million people. And writing in Clifton County, there's 30,000. So it's a lot easier for me to have these personal connections. Or Emmy, you know, being the sheriff's department is in charge of the county, so they sort of float around, but each city has its own police department. And so a lot of times, if she doesn't have a personal connection to a case, she at least knows the person in the police department who's investigating it.
It's you run into this. I've seen this in the like detective shows or police procedural shows, things like that. Like eventually, I think someone would start to question why so many people are dying in this little town.
Right. Yeah. That's where I got to in Grant County. You know, it was pedophiles and murderers. It was like Congress.
Yeah, you should have said it in DC. You would have at least had more of an excuse.
Yes.
So, what goes into planning? Okay, so you're thinking ahead. You've got a couple of ideas ahead. Have you already mapped these out? I'm sure you have at least one, as
Yeah,
Sequel
well, a
says.
couple of them I've got loose ideas. I'm not, you know, the usual question is, are you a plotter or a pantser?
I
Do
was
you go
going
by
there next. Yeah.
chance? Yeah. And I'm a little bit of both. You know, the emotional stuff I figure out as I go along, but the actual plot, the scaffolding of the whodunit, that's very firmly in place before I start writing. I've always been someone who has to know before I start who the bad guy is or bad woman, and you know, the accomplices along the way. And I feel like that's important to my writing because I play very fair with the reader. I never have a butler come in at the end and, you know, it's the butler did it. It's always someone who you meet along the way, and the clues are there for you to be able to figure it out. Now, you also have to accept some people will figure it out, and you have to write for them so that it's still interesting and they want to, you know, maybe they're 99% sure, but they want to be certain they're sure, and they want to know more particularly how Emmy is going to figure out who the bad person is.
I guess at that point you're actually just trying to make it fun for them to get confirmation, right? Like
Yeah,
you were
absolutely.
right, guys.
We all think we're right about things that we're not right about. And you know, also I think there are a lot of readers who say, I figured it out, but you think, well, maybe you figured it out when I told you could figure it out. So a bit of that manipulation that goes on that maybe people aren't aware of as they read.
That's an interesting idea, and I've thought about that too. It's like, are you actually do sort of reveal before the reveal, right? Like somewhere earlier. How do you manage that without giving it away to the people who still haven't caught on?
Well, you know, you have to just play with expectations, and you have to do Mr. X, and you know, all the red herrings and all that kind of stuff is very important to the storytelling. But I mean, the thing is, you just have to tell a good story and accept that you're not going to fool all the people. You're going to fool a lot of them, but there are people who read crime novels with the intention of figuring it out, and I'm not one of those. I just want to read it and let it wash over me and be immersed in the story. And you know, some people read the last page, which is crazy,
Oh
because
yeah,
they
I've
just
never
can't
gotten that.
stand. Yeah, I've never. I always. I don't even read the jacket copy. I always want to be surprised.
And I want to be continually surprised, which is why it's irritating when I do figure out what's going on too soon. Like,
Yeah.
there's a real, now it's a slog to finish the book rather than just, letting it pull me along. How are you, I mean, are you doing things that kind of maybe keep people from, like, how are you hiding it all, I guess? What's the process?
Yeah, I mean, you just have to make every character count and think of every character as having their own story and their own detail and give them a life. You know, particularly in this novel where I'm writing about the abduction of young girls, I'm very conscious that happens a lot of times, right? I mean, it's a crime that happens every day in the United States, multiple times a day in some instances. And you know, very rarely is it a stranger abduction. I think 1% of child abductions are a stranger. Usually it's a parent or a pastor or someone in the child's life, right? Who has access to the child. And we don't, you know, we tell kids don't talk to strangers, but we should also be telling them, hey, if Uncle Bob makes you feel uncomfortable, you need to tell me. It's yeah. okay. Yeah. We don't really concentrate on those conversations. So, and particularly when young girls are involved, we have this knee jerk reaction to not believe them yeah. and think they want attention or, you know, all these other things that are completely made up excuses
yeah. Yeah.
to excuse what's very bad behavior. You know, we have the phrase boys will be boys. But we don't have a phrase for girls that gives them the same amount of, license just to be children.
Yeah. 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 That's a very good point. It's unfair and very slanted, and, you know, and unfortunately it makes for sloppy storytelling too, because it's so cliche, you know, like the motive of the killer is that he's just, you know, I don't know. He's just being a boy. He's just being his nature or whatever. That's very sloppy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very lazy.
Well, I mean, we know that youth can change the stamp of nature.
Yeah.
So, you know, it does take away the guilt, right? Because all crimes are choices that people yeah. make. They're not victims if they're committing these crimes. Right. But we do, you know, it plays into the title of the book, We Are All Guilty Here. And I'm certainly not exhibiting women, because women can be the worst perpetrators of this belief that, you know, a 15-year-old girl is victimized, but we want to know a little bit more about her before we will say she's a victim, right?
Yeah.
And if particularly if sex is involved, we give her agency that she never had in the interaction, or, you know, she's mature for her age, or she went through puberty early, or as if, you know, having breasts means that suddenly she thinks like a woman rather than a 15-year-old little girl.
Right, right. So, you know, in stories like these, the characters, even the characters that aren't actively participating in the story, need to, in order for you to have that sense of empathy for the victim, and maybe even some kind of empathy for the bad guy, because sometimes that's how you make the bad guy really bad, is to sort of empathize with them somehow. What do you do to like flesh out characters, especially like side characters? What do you do to make them feel real?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good point, just that every character should feel real.
Yeah.
You know, there's no red shirt ensign in my books from Star Trek that, you know, is going to be killed or is the bad guy. And, you know, part of the way to do that is just to give details about everyone. And when I envision characters, you know, I give them traits, or I give them some sort of identity to make them memorable. And it may not be that it needs to be memorable because they're involved in something nefarious. It's just because, you know, I want to be able to hide the bad person in this group
right.
of people.
Right.
The way you do that is to make them all matter.
Yeah.
There's never going to be a throwaway character in one of my novels. Every single character you meet is going to have the feeling of being a real person.
Yeah. And I think that's vital, right? Cause it's like zebra stripes. I mean, that's what you got going. The killer has to be able to hide among the herd, right?
Yeah.
If you're not going to figure it out right away. If the guy's walking around with, like, you know, a rose in his lapel, and yeah. it's going to be pretty easy to spot. So,
yeah. I mean, particularly when you're dealing with predators against young girls, they look like priests.
Yeah.
Look like teachers. They look like what we would call normal everyday people.
Yeah.
And one thing I bring out in the book is that when someone is grooming a child, they're not just grooming a child, they're grooming everyone around that child,
right?
To create this idea that they're a good person. You know, they're going to help you move furniture or water your plants, or going to be with you, you know, when you need them. And that is in service to the bad stuff they're doing. That's not who they are.
Yeah.
Who they are is who that child sees. And so I think we need to, like, have a deeper understanding, because everybody's like, oh, you know, my neighbor, I never thought he would do something like this. Well, yeah, because your neighbor was making you think he was a good person so that he could do bad things.
You're right. This is dark stuff, dark subject matter. Like, how do you balance that, you know, because I know what it is, I know what it is to sit and be in one of these worlds for long stretches of time. Like, how do you shake that off and go about a normal life afterward?
Well, I mean, part of it is just as a woman, I'm so aware every single day,
Yeah.
every interaction I have that, you know, there are people like that out there. I mean, I think the first time a man ever exposed himself to me, I was 9 years old,
Yeah.
on a field trip with a bus full of girls. So, you know, that kind of thing is just what women are used to dealing with on a daily basis. And we are, you know, we don't really talk about it because it's just, you might as well talk about breathing.
Right.
And so, you know, we shake it off and we go on, and you know, we know, I mean, we should say hashtag not all men, right? It's a hell of a lot of men, but not all men.
Right.
And you know, I think it's the same with writing. You know, when I'm talking about these acts of violence, or I will say I've killed men in my books too, but no one seems to care about you guys.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay, he deserved it. You know, whenever there's a male victim, no one ever talks about the violence in those. It's always when it's directed toward a woman, which, you know, it's
Interesting.
great. Hey, it's great that
Yeah.
women matter, when they are bludgeoned to death. But I think it's important to always have a balance in your life. Not and and in the books, you know, there's in We Are All Guilty Here, there's a good sense of humor. Characters make mistakes. They find themselves in crazy situations, just like you do in real life. And you
Yeah.
know, I love reading, I love rowing on my rowing machine and going on the treadmill and going for walks and just
Yes.
taking a break when
Yeah.
I need to take a break. But I think if you're a writer, you're called to writing.
Yes.
Writing chooses you, so it's not something that I ever envision being able to stop doing.
Talk about bludgeoning. Like, writing doesn't just choose you, it beats the crap out of you and won't let you escape the
Yeah.
house. So
Yeah.
this title, by the way, is one I love because We Are All Guilty Here tells a story all on its own. Like, it hints at things. Like, I without even reading the book and just knowing what little I know about it, that title tells me something I might expect. What is there a theme you're going for there? Was there did the t did you choose the title, by the way? I know sometimes that
Yeah,
this the
and
pub
it comes from
yeah
a line that Emmy says in the book because
yeah
she's talking to her son, who's feeling bad about, you know, the cop, about things that that they missed in this investigation.
Right.
And you know, she says to him, kind of trying to let him off the hook, "We are all guilty here." And you know, there is a certain level of complicity though that this talks about at a larger level. You know, the way we dismiss young girls, the way we don't want to hear their stories, we're all guilty of that. I mean, and you know, particularly women
Yeah.
are incredibly judgmental of other women, not just as teenage girls, but as mothers, as daughters, as sisters. You know, there's a lot of judging that goes on. You know, Emmy also has a sister, Jude, who comes in later in the story. And, you know, you have women at two different points in their lives, one where they're all caught up in that and one where they just don't give a shit, right?
Right.
And so that to me was interesting to write. And I know just from my sisters and my friends who have had children, you know, the parent you are when you're in your 30s is so different from the parent you are when you're in your 40s or
Yes.
50s, even, you know, and you just think, why did I care so much about that? Why did I want to fight that battle? And you know, unfortunately, knowledge and wisdom come with age.
Yeah. And exhaustion
Yeah.
also come. Yeah, this is do you I have this whole thing where I, you know, story, I have this I guess a grand idea that story serves a purpose sort of above and beyond just entertainment. Like, it shapes our culture, you know, shapes who we are. You know, do you aim to serve anything like that with what you're writing? Is that anywhere in your mind?
I do, but that's a secondary thing. I mean,
Yeah.
primarily, I want to write a thriller someone can take to the beach and read and enjoy. And But if they want deeper meaning, that's there. But that's how thrillers have always been. I mean, the first crime novel written in America was by a woman, and it's called The Dead Letter. And it was dismissed because it was written by a woman. But you know, and I should say Poe wrote the first short story, right?
Yeah.
Murder in the Rue Morgue. But it was focusing on like a very domestic thing. The dead letter being, this person finds a letter that was never delivered at the post office, and they call that a dead letter. And from that, it kicks off this whole mystery of who wrote the letter and, you know, what happened to the person who was going to receive it and that kind of thing. But it's also like it's talking about society and, you know, the changes in this society. This was around the time of the Industrial Revolution, so that comes in. And, you know, so I think when I'm writing my stories, I'm picking up on that. And crime novels, whether it's To Kill a Mockingbird or The Great Gatsby, you know, which people forget has a murder also.
Right, yeah.
Great, and, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird is like a courtroom drama. But they hold up a mirror to society, and I try to do that as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the book is We Are All Guilty Here. This is the first book in the North Falls Thrillers, available on August 12th. So people can probably, I'm not entirely sure when this episode airs, but I'm guessing it's before that. So you can pre-order until then. Karen Slaughter, thank you so much for chatting with us, sharing your experience and details about the book. I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
So she said at one point that she wanted a bigger canvas with this new series, and that I understand, I think, where she's coming from with that. But like, have you ever felt like you've outgrown the world that you were writing in? You wanted to start fresh.
I got lucky and started with Chicago out of the gate, so there's no shortage of that kind of activity there. But I can see where she had a problem. Like, her books are fantastic, but like, there is so much bad stuff going on in this particular little town. Like, the real estate value must be down in the toilet.
Yeah, I think thrillers and mysteries work well in like rural settings and like small towns. Like, there's just something I think inherently, you know, secretive, and like, so you kind of already have that. But yeah, if you've got like 8, 9, 10 books, like you just said, like the plausibility almost start, like how it's like in Grey's Anatomy, you know, or like season 6, it's just like, okay, like these people have survived what now?
Well, it's one of the, I think you just kind of hit the nail on the head there. You know, like these mysteries tend to work best when it is a small town, you know, just because you've got that environment and that feel. But the way she laid this out, you know, the way she explained it sounds perfect. She's got, you know, the rich people over here in their little subdivision. You've got other people over here. You know, like, she's got it all figured out. I mean, like, right down to like who's on the school board and stuff. And like, and that's how it plays out in real life. But if you think of all those pieces on the board, you know, as a writer, you know, that's 20 books, you know, easily. You can bounce back and forth with all these different things. You're not stuck. So she definitely thought it through on the second go around.
Yeah. I know that in my own, you know, I've written, there's a couple of series that I've written now for, you know, a decade, and I'm not tired of them per se. Like, I'm writing a new one in my Kotler books right now, but there is kind of some burnout that happens when you've been writing in like one headspace for that long. So I can see the urge to want to branch out, you know, because there are some certain limitations. Like, there's things that because I created this character who has certain credentials and a certain personality and has this history, I'm kind of locked in on things that I can and can't do with that character. And the same would be said for her and her original setting. Like, you know, there's only so much you can do in this environment before it just, you know, you lose interest, but maybe it becomes unrealistic. That's the kind of thing readers can overlook. But for the writer, like, you start to lose interest. Like, I already did that. I've already done that. You know, so I can totally see why you would want to shift gears. She also said that her publisher lets her just kind of chase whatever projects she wants. How important do you think it is for you to have that kind of creative freedom, and what do you have to do to protect that?
Well, she's a proven entity at this point, so they know that she knows the magic formula, that they're not going to tell her what it is, so they're going to give her that free rein. But I know early on in pretty much every author's career, they're extremely careful about that sort of thing. Like a lot of times, if you've got a 2-book contract, they signed you because of the first book. They want to see a ton of details on that second book before you start the writing process, and they want to make sure that it's going to work and kind of feel it out. But with somebody like her, I mean, like you just let her write whatever the hell she wants, you know?
Yeah, I think it's like that's a good lesson in at least the way I do it is, have like your idea notebook and you have ideas because I have, a bunch of ideas and some are stronger than others, but you kind of have to let go of, especially early on, let go of the outcome and focus on the process and then I guess gamify it. So like, if I had to like pitch a bunch of novels and I've done this. it's like whatever one gets picked, you just like, okay, go all in. Like you kind of can't be precious about it. And you just have to have, I guess, the confidence that like if it's a good idea, it'll come to life at some point. It doesn't have to come to life right now. At least that's kind of how I approach it. Like just try to accept it and just go all in with like whatever the publisher wants you to do.
See, like I want to write what I'm interested in, but I also don't mind constraints. I don't mind that at all. I actually find that makes me more creative when it's like, okay, you need to write something.
You tackle it like a puzzle almost. It's like, all right, this is what we're doing. Okay, well, how can I make this fun? And how can I make this interesting? And you just kind of go for it.
That's a good way to put it too, because it's a little bit like packing luggage for a road trip. You got a limited space. You got to make all the things fit in that space. How are you going to do it?
I think
See.
it's just when you're in this, even when you're someone big, like at a certain point, like you can't be precious about your work, like it's a product. And I think like there is creative freedom and there is like, wanting to pursue the things that you're interested in, but like you also have to balance that with it being a product. So like
Well, think about J.T. Ellison. We had her on a couple of weeks ago. She wanted to write a romance novel, and then she got pushed back from all corners, and it ended up becoming a horror novel, which is what they wanted in the end.
And she's
I mean,
happy
what I,
with it.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where she's comfortable. I mean, what I used to do, and I still do to a certain extent, but I had a list of like the ideas that I wanted to write, and I only shared, like the ones that I particularly wanted to write in that moment. And then I let my agents and editors weigh in on those, those 5 or 10, and then, let them pick from there. But like, I wouldn't give them something I wasn't 100% passionate about in that moment. Because you don't want to write something that you're just not into, because then that's going to come across on the page too.
Yeah, if someone was like, write a biography, I'd be like, no, I really don't enjoy writing nonfiction.
So you guys keep idea journals and things like that. Like, how do you? Okay, because the way I do that is I don't. I stopped trying to keep track of ideas 100 years ago because it became a weight for some reason. Like, because when I did get a chance to loop back around, try to write that story, now I felt like I was being restricted to that idea. But what I do instead is I tend to think and work in titles. So, like the book I'm working on now, the title occurred to me and I thought that'd be a great Kotler book. And so I created a Scrivener file with that title back in like 2022. And so it's been sitting there waiting for me to loop back around and finally write it one day. And I've got an entire list of those in that. There's Scrivener files with all kinds of different Kotler titles.
Interesting.
And so I have no idea what the book is about until I start writing it, though.
So I interviewed Tade Thompson a long, long time ago, for Lit Reactor when that website was still up. And he actually, every Wednesday, part of his writing routine is to do 20 ideas. So he has to come up with like 20 ideas every Wednesday, or it doesn't count as a writing day. And he said, like, sometimes it's a character, sometimes it's, an idea. Maybe it turns into a short story. Maybe it turns into a character subplot. Maybe it's a piece of dialogue. Like, but he just has to get those things. And then when he gets stuck writing, he goes to that and he's like, oh, that would work for this situation. And so instead of thinking of like ideas as like whole entities, like, I started approaching it that way, where it's like you just kind of get like maybe a scene or something. And then you just kind of like write it down. And then maybe that works for some other book or it changes in some way. But I like looking at, but I like puzzles, so maybe that's where that fits in for me. It's like a puzzle piece.
Yeah, that's
Well,
a
I'll
cool
give you
idea.
another case where it's helpful. So, like, I always keep a title, a tagline, and then a backup book blurb for pretty much every idea. So, I've got all those on hand. But I signed with a new film agent a few years ago. And one of the things that he's been giving me over the years is like feedback that he gets out of these meetings that he has. So, he'll walk into a meeting with Sony to pitch a project, and not necessarily mine. But when he leaves that meeting, a lot of times they tell them what they're looking for. So then he'll come back to me and he sends all that stuff to me as a list. They're looking for this type of story that takes place with, in this area, these types of characters. And then I can go through my list of potential books and say, hey, well, this one fits and this one fits and this one fits. And it kind of gets the ball rolling from the opposite side. And then you've got a studio that's already interested from the get-go.
That's
Smart.
cool.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay. I guess I should ask JD who's up next week.
Next week, we've got Lisa Gardner coming back on. Lisa's the number one New York Times bestselling author of numerous thrillers. She's also a self-described research junkie, one of the best authors out there when it comes to the police procedurals working today. She's here to tell us about her latest novel, Kiss Her Goodbye, which releases August 12th.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.